His words failed to make her fully conscious of her human vulnerability and the fact that she might die out here. Even when she was not talking, she did not restore the face flap of her stillsuit. Leto recognized the unconscious motivation behind this failure, but knew the futility of addressing that directly. In the late afternoon, night's chill already starting to creep over the land, he began regaling her with songs of the long trek which had not been saved in the oral history. He enjoyed the fact that she liked one of his favorites, Liet's March. "The tune is really ancient," he said, "a pre-space thing of old Terra."
"Would you sing it again?"
He chose one of his best baritones, a long-dead artist who had filled many a concert hall. "The wall of past beyond recall hides me from an ancient fall where all the waters tumble, and plays of sprays carve caves and clays beneath a torrent's rumble." When he had finished, she was silent for a moment, then,
"That's an odd song for marching."
"They liked it because they could dissect it," he said.
"Dissect?"
"Before our Fremen ancestors came to this planet, night was the time for storytelling, songs, and poetry. In the Dune days, though, that was reserved for the false dark, the daytime gloom of the Siege. The night was when they could emerge and move about, just as we do now."
"But you said dissect."
"What does that song mean?" he asked.
"Oh, it's just a song."
"Siona!"
She heard anger in his voice and remained silent.
"This planet is the child of the worm," he warned her, "and I am that worm."
She responded with a surprising insouciance.
"Then tell me what it means."
"The insect has no more freedom from its hive than we have freedom from our past," he said. "The caves are there, and all of the messages written in the sprays of the torrents."
"I prefer dancing songs," she said.
It was a flippant answer, but Leto chose to take it as a change of subject. He told her about the marriage dance of Fremen women, tracing the steps back to the whirling of dust devils. Leto prided himself on telling a good story. It was clear from her rapt attention that she could see the women whirling before her inner eye, long black hair thrown in the ancient movements, straggling across long dead faces. Darkness was almost upon them when he finished.
"Come," he said. "Morning and evening are still the times of silhouettes. Let us see if anyone shares our desert."
Siona followed him up to a dune crest, and they stared all around at the darkening desert. There was only one bird high overhead, attracted by their movements. From the splayed gap tips on its wings and the shape, he knew it was a vulture. He pointed this out to Siona.
"But what do they eat?" she asked.
"Anything that's dead, or nearly so."
This hit her, and she stared up at the last of the sunlight gilding the lone bird's flight feathers. Leto pressed it.
"A few people still venture into my sphere. Sometimes a museum Fremen wanders off and gets lost. They're really only good at the rituals. And then there are the desert's edges and the remains of whatever my wolves leave."
At this, she whirled away from him, but not before he saw the passion still consuming her. Siona was being sorely tested.
"There's little daytime graciousness about a desert," he said. "That's another reason we traveled by night. To a Fremen, the image of the day was that of wind-blown sand filling your tracks."
Her eyes glistened with unshed tears when she turned back to him, but her features were composed.
"What lives here now?" she asked.
"The vultures, a few night creatures, an occasional remnant of plant life out of the old days, burrowing things."
"Is that all?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"Because this is where they were born, and I permit them to know nothing better."
It was almost dark with that sudden glowing light his desert acquired in these moments. He studied her in that luminous moment, recognizing that she had not yet understood his other message. He knew that message would sit there, though, and fester in her.
"Silhouettes," she said, reminding him. "What did you expect to find when we came up here?"
"Perhaps people at a distance. You're never certain."
"What people?"
"I've already told you."
"What would you have done if you'd seen anyone?"
"It was the Fremen custom to treat distant people as hostile until they threw sand into the air."
As he spoke, darkness fell over them like a curtain. Siona became ghostly movement in the sudden starlight.
"Sand?" she asked.
"Thrown sand is a profound gesture. It says, we share the same burden. Sand is our only enemy. This is what we drink. The hand that holds sand holds no weapon. Do you understand this?
No.
She taunted him with a defiant falsehood.
You will, he said.
Without a word, she set out along the arc of their dune, striding away from him with an angry excess of energy. Leto allowed himself to fall far behind her, interested that she had instinctively chosen the right direction. Fremen memories could be felt churning in her. Where the dune dipped to cross another, she waited for him. He saw that the face flap of her stillsuit remained open, hanging loose. It was not yet time to chide her about this. Some unconscious things had to run their natural course. As he came up to her, she said,
"Is this as good a direction as any other?"
"If you keep to it," he said.
She glanced up at the stars, and he saw her identify the pointers, those Fremen arrows which had led her ancestors across this land. He could see, though, that her recognition was mostly intellectual. She had not yet come to accept the other things working within her. Leto lifted his front segments to peer ahead in the starlight. They were moving a little west of north on a track that once had led across Abanya Ridge and Cave of Birds into the Erg below False Wall West and the way to Wind Pass. None of those landmarks remained. He sniffed a cool breeze with flint smells in it and more moisture than he found pleasant. Once more Siona set off, slower this time, holding her course by occasional glances at the stars. She had trusted Leto to confirm the way, but now she guided herself. He sensed the turmoil beneath her wary thoughts, and he knew the things which were emerging. She had the beginnings of that intense loyalty to traveling companions which desert folk always trusted.
"We know," he thought. "If you are separated from your companions, you are lost among dunes and rocks. The lone traveler in the desert is dead. Only the worm lives alone out here."
He let her get well ahead of him where the grating sand of his passage would not be too prominent. She had to think of his human self. He counted on loyalty to work for him. Siona was brittle, though, filled with suppressed rage, more of a rebel than any other he had ever tested. Leto glided along behind her, reviewing the breeding program, shaping the necessary decisions for a replacement should she fail. As the night progressed, Siona moved slower and slower. First moon was high overhead, and second moon well above the horizon before she stopped to rest and eat. Leto was glad of the pause. Friction had set up a worm dominance, the air around him full of the chemical exhalations from his temperature adjustments. The thing he thought of as his oxygen supercharger vented steadily, making him intensely aware of the protein factories and amino acid resources his worm self had acquired to accommodate the placental relationship with his human cells. Desert quickened the movement toward his final metamorphosis. Siona had stopped near the crest of a star dune.
"Is it true that you eat the sand?" she asked as he came up to her.
"It's true."
She stared all around the moon-frosted horizon.
"Why didn't we bring a signal device?"
"I wanted you to learn about possessions."
She turned toward him. He sensed her breath close to his face. She was losing too much moisture into the dry air. Still, she did not remember Maneo's admonition. It would be a bitter lesson, no doubt of that.
"I don't understand you at all," she said.
"Yet you are committed to doing just that."
"Am I?"
"How else can you give me something of value in exchange for what I give you?"
"What do you give me?"
All of the bitterness was there, and a hint of the spice from her dried food.
"I give you this opportunity to be alone with me, to share with me, and you spend this time without concern. You waste it."
"What about possessions?" she demanded.
He heard fatigue in her voice, the water message beginning to scream within her.
"They were magnificently alive in the old days, those Fremen," he said, "and their eye for beauty was limited to that which was useful. I never met a greedy Fremen."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"In the old days, everything you took into the desert was a necessity, and that was all you took. Your life is no longer free of possessions, Siona, or you would not have asked about a signal device."
"Why isn't a signal device necessary?"
"It would teach you nothing."
He moved out around her along the track indicated by the pointers.
"Come, let us use this night to our profit."
She came hurrying up to walk beside his cowled face.
"What happens if I don't learn your damned lesson?"
"You'll probably die," he said.
That silenced her for a time. She trudged along beside him, with only an occasional sideward glance, ignoring the worm body, concentrating on the visible remnants of his humanity. After a time, she said,
"The fish speakers told me that you ordered the mating from which I was born.
That's true.
They say you keep records, and that you order these Atreides matings for your own purposes.
That also is true.
Then the oral history is correct.
I thought you believed the oral history without question.
She was on a single track, though.
What if one of us objects when you order a mating?
I allow a wide latitude, just as long as there are the children I have ordered.
Ordered?
She was outraged.
That's what I do.
You can't creep into every bedroom, or follow every one of us every minute of our lives. How do you know your orders are obeyed?
I know.
Then you know I'm not going to obey you.
Are you thirsty, Siona?
She was startled.
What?
Thirsty people speak of water, not of sex.
Still, she did not seal her mouth flap, and he thought,
Atreides' passions always did run strong, even at the expense of reason.
Within 2 hours, they came down out of the dunes onto a wind-scoured flat of pebbles. Leto moved on to it, Siona close to his side. She looked frequently at the pointers. Both moons were low on the horizon now, and their light cast long shadows behind every boulder. In some ways, Leto found such places more comfortable to traverse than the sand. Solid rock was a better heat conductor than sand. He could flatten himself against the rock and ease the working of his chemical factories. Pebbles and even sizable rocks did not impede him. Siona had more trouble here, though, and almost turned an ankle several times. The flatland could be a very trying place for humans unaccustomed to it, he thought. If they stayed close to the ground, they saw only the great emptiness, an eerie place especially in moonlight, dunes at a distance which seemed not to change as the traveler moved. Nothing anywhere except the seemingly eternal wind, a few rocks, and, when they looked upward, stars without mercy. This was the desert of the desert.
"Here's where Fremen music acquired its eternal loneliness," he said, "not up on the dunes. Here's where you really learn to think that heaven must be the sound of running water and relief, any relief, from that endless wind."
Even this did not remind her of that face flap. Leto began to despair. Morning found them far out on the flat. Leto stopped beside three large boulders, all piled against each other, one of them taller even than his back. Siona leaned against him for a moment, a gesture which restored Leto's hopes somewhat. She pushed herself away presently and clambered up onto the highest boulder. He watched her turn up there, examining the landscape. Without even looking at it, Leto knew what she saw. Blowing sand like fog on the horizon obscured the rising sun. For the rest, there was only the flat and the wind. The rock was cold beneath him with the chill of a desert morning. The cold made the air much drier, and he found it more pleasant. Without Siona, he would have moved on, but she was visibly exhausted. She leaned against him once more when she came down from the rock, and it was almost a minute before he realized that she was listening.
"What do you hear?"
he asked. She spoke sleepily.
"You rumble inside."
"The fire never goes completely out."
This interested her. She pushed herself away from his side and came around to look into his face.
"Fire?"
"Every living thing has a fire within it, some slow, some very fast. Mine is hotter than most."
She hugged herself against the chill.
"Then you're not cold here?"
"No, but I can see that you are."
He pulled his face partly into its cowl and created a depression at the bottom arc of his first segment.
"It's almost like a hammock," he said, looking down. "If you curl up there, you will be warm."
Without hesitating, she accepted his invitation. Even though he had prepared her for it, he found the trusting response touching. He had to fight against a feeling of pity far stronger than any he had experienced before knowing Hui. There could be no room for pity out here, though, he told himself. Siona was betraying clear signs that she would more than likely die here. He had to prepare himself for disappointment. Siona shielded her face with an arm, closed her eyes, and went to sleep.
"Nobody has ever had as many yesterdays as I have had," he reminded himself.
From the popular human viewpoint, he knew that the things he did here could only appear cruel and callous. He was forced now to strengthen himself by retreating into his memories, deliberately selecting
mistakes of our common past.
First-hand access to human mistakes was his greatest strength now. Knowledge of mistakes taught him long-term corrections. He had to be constantly aware of consequences. If consequences were lost or concealed, lessons were lost. But the closer he came to being a sandworm, the harder he found it to make decisions which others would call inhuman. Once he had done it with ease. As his humanity slipped away, though, he found himself filled with more and more human concerns.
In the cradle of our past, I lay upon my back in a cave so shallow I could penetrate it only by squirming, not by crawling. There, by the dancing light of a resin torch, I drew upon walls and ceiling the creatures of the hunt and the souls of my people. How illuminating it is to peer backward through a perfect circle at that ancient struggle for the visible moment of the soul. All time vibrates to that call. Here I am. With a mind informed by artist giants who came afterward, I peer at handprints and flowing muscles drawn upon the rock with charcoal and vegetable dyes. How much more we are than mere mechanical events! And my anti-civil self demands, why is it that they do not want to leave the cave?
The stolen journals.